Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
The Congo River Basin includes six countries and covers approximately 3.7 million square kilometers, making it the world's second largest rainforest basin behind only the Amazon. Like the Amazon, in practical terms, it is vital to the health of the planet. But also like the Amazon, scientists and conservationists worry that the basin's ecology could tip if the rainforests are destroyed or seriously degraded. I have the fortune today to have an opportunity for a conversation with someone who knows the basin from 50,000 feet, but also from 5 feet from the ground. Jaap van der Waard has worked for the last two decades in the Congo Basin. Today, he is the World Wildlife Fund's conservation director for the region. He will be speaking, of course, on a personal level, not for the WWF. Welcome, Jaap, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you.
So let's start at 50,000 feet, but we will get to five.
Yeah.
You've worked at least two decades, maybe longer, on the basin. As we sit here today, what has most changed from the first time you undertook the job?
When I started, I came for the first time in 2004. That was before I started working on WWF. And I felt I came to a developing region, developing country, expecting growth and development, and things were going to go on the way up. That was my expectation. After 20 years, I realized that the Congo Basin as a region and as a whole been relatively stagnant, relatively stable, if you like.
Whereas other regions, stable is better than stagnant.
Well, it's
a little bit of both, I suspect.
It's a little bit of both, yeah. It's stable in the sense that if you look at the deforestation rates, they're quite low. So we call most of these countries high forest, low deforestation, HFLD countries, which is a good thing. You got a lot of forest and still there. And the rate at which it's disappearing is relatively low as compared to other regions like Southeast Asia or the Amazon. Stagnant in the way of economic growth. These countries, they all have ambitions to grow up in the ladder of socioeconomic development. They want to see development for their population. They want to see growth in general. And that is not really happening. If I look at the state of the roads, the state of the buildings, the state of, you know, the region as a whole, it's been relatively stagnant. So there's a slow decrease, if you like, there's been a lot of decrease in biodiversity. So we've been losing a lot of the big fauna, like elephants. And that has to do with international trade for ivory, poaching, all that. The forest itself is relatively stable, I'd say.
That's the good news. It's relatively stable. Is it stable because of positive things that are being done, or is it the absence of bad things that are being done?
It's a little bit of both, but the biggest difference, if you like, if you compare the Amazon, Congo Basin, and Southeast Asia, is that in Southeast Asia and the Amazon, you got big, big agro-industrial developments. Borneo lost half of its forest to palm oil. The Amazon, you got huge soy plantation, you got cattle ranging. We don't have that in the Congo Basin. And it's not because it's not possible, because the palm oil tree is actually a Central African tree, native to the region. But the Congo Basin countries are importing palm oil from Malaysia. The governments don't like that. They think they should be, and that's a good reason for that, to be self-sufficient for their own food. Certainly for a crop that's endemic to their own region. But the reason it's not happening is that you need industrial development for that. And I think one problem for the region is that the investment climate is so difficult that a lot of companies find it not attractive to really invest. So these countries have problems attracting finance, attracting business. And that, in a way, is then a blessing for the forest because it's not being clear cut as it's been doing in other places.
Do you worry that something will change that dynamic for the worst in terms of the forest?
I wouldn't say I'm worried. I'm more determined to see that the development does come, but it doesn't come with the cost that we've seen in other places. So for instance, palm oil, you can grow palm oil in savanna areas. The Congo Basin, not just forest. There's lots of savanna areas as well. Now, savanna areas, like I'm Dutch, and in the Netherlands, we talk about preserving biodiversity in our own country. The biodiversity value of savannas in Africa is way higher than what we find in nature reserves in the Netherlands. Still, we think that if you want to develop palm oil in the Congo Basin, you should do that in the savanna. So there's going to be a negative impact on that savanna, but it's not as bad as chopping down a whole native forest. So if development comes, if palm oil comes, we should guide that to places where the biodiversity values and the high carbon stocks are low or lowest, so preserving the high biodiversity areas. And then it doesn't need to go to the extent or expense of the forest, of the biodiversity, and the countries can provide their own food and even make money off export. It's feasible.
It's feasible, but what would it take? Because the bad example of this, as you said, is the Amazon, where so much clear cutting, and it continues. The deforestation of the Amazon is accelerating, not decelerating. So once they've got the disease, they've got it badly. How do you prevent, how do you guide, to use your word, that kind of development?
So the challenge is that for to develop palm oil, the cheapest way to do that is to cut down a forest, because in a forest, there's no people living, so you don't need to compensate for translocating people, giving them somewhere else to live. The forest floor is still quite nutritious, so you have a healthy land. So, and the timber that you cut down, you can still sell. Your upfront investment cost, you recuperate that by selling the timber, and you don't have much cost in developing the land. That's why the Amazon, the Borneo model is so successful, so popular. So this is what we need to change. And the only way to do that is to have a government that says, I don't want this. And a investor or a company says, that's not the way we do business. And there's sort of two places where we can influence. One is invite companies, promote companies that want to do it right, to invest in the right places like savannas, and with the governments to try to make them see the long-term benefit for them to preserve their forest and to develop elsewhere. It comes at a higher cost, so someone needs to pay, and that's always the same story. The consumer in the end has to pay. So the consumer has to pay for a good product and not the cheapest possible product that there is. So it takes two to tango. It takes the government and it takes the private sector to embrace that idea that we want to do the right thing.
Another potentially disruptive force, but could be for good or for bad, is the potential for the analog to the green transition, that is to say, the mining of rare earths, other minerals, oil, etc. And we know that the DRC is currently negotiating with anybody who will come by, with the Chinese, with the Americans, with Europeans. We know there are rare earths and other minerals that have not been developed, partially because there's no infrastructure. It's that same circular issue. But we also know that the demand for energy is almost vertical at the moment. So the prices of this will justify people making these frontier investments in places like the DRC and elsewhere. Again, there might be an opportunity, as you implied, on the agricultural side to guide it, that it hasn't happened. You can see the train coming right at you. There is a chance to turn it into the best possible, to mix my metaphor, best possible solution for these countries rather than the disaster that those kinds of resource booms have often been for others in other parts of the world.
If you look at the long-term economic development plans of basically all the countries in the Congo Basin, their top two is agro-industry and mining. That's their hope. And frankly, that is also the easiest chance. So if you look at the mining, with agro-industry, you can choose where to go. With the mining, you have no
choice. It's already been chosen for you.
There you are. So the the approach that we propose is that instead of just having all these individual projects doing their own impact assessment and then trying to do the rest, what we'd like to see happening is that we take the region as a whole, or we take bigger landscapes where the mining is projected and look at that landscape and then do what we call strategic social environmental impact assessments. So there's cumulative impacts. If all the projects in that landscape would be developed, palm oil, mine, a railroad, a road, a harbor, if all that would happen, what would be the impact on people and on the landscape? And if that is what you know, then you can start looking, well, if I do it a little bit different, like I do the railroad a little bit different, or maybe I don't develop five mines, but only do three, or out of the ones that I can choose, I take the ones with the least impact. For the company, individual company, that is not in their interest because everybody's at their stake in a place. But the state can choose. The state can decide, okay, we're going to develop this area in a way that is least impact on people and planet, on the forest. So this is our approach as WWF, but that's what I really feel strongly about, is that we're not against development. And I'm also the one using, so the iron, there's a lot of iron mining going on there, for instance, in Triton. That iron, for instance, is going for windmills development. Yeah, windmills we see as positive. So it's not that we can be against all of the mining. But to guide it in a way that is least impactful, I think, is important. That is one. And then secondly, once the mine does get developed, there should be serious offsetting taking place. So all the impacts that they create, negative impacts, they need to offset. So the mines will pay for the protection of the forest in that area. So the mine becomes them a net positive contributor. So they will dig up a hole in the ground. A mountain will become a hole, and then there'll be a railroad from that mountain to the coast. But then if they pay enough to protect the land around it, then it might actually become a force for good. There will always be negative impacts. But the money is so big that if it's played right by the governments, then they can actually protect a lot of forests with that. Now, this is very controversial. And there's a lot of people who would not be interested, like the mines themselves, for one. This is our chance to minimize impacts and maximize contribution to conservation.
To make that work, you at least need two conditions. You need government capacity and you need government interest. Do you have enough of either or both in the region?
So there's a lot of supporting institutions, if you like. So what we want to do is we work, for instance, with there's the committee of the Central African Forest Ministries, COMIFAC, and there's the ECAS, which is the Economic Committee for the African Central African States. They have some convening power. To make sure that the governments at least talk to each other and that they come to a common agreement. So this is way far removed from our own influence. But if these trans-state organizations are involved, they can organize the states to get involved. And then, of course, it's the finance, the money talks. So who's behind all these investments? This is one mine can easily cost $5 billion to develop. So a bit with the railroad. So there's got to be money involved. And money means banks and financial institutions. And they are sensitive to arguments of social and environmental impacts. So if the financing institutions are aware of this and they agree in a way to follow up on recommendation of such a strategic impact assessment, and then, of course, because it's their money, then they would invest in the management of the whole affair, then there's a chance. What we need to prevent is that we all say that the Congo Basin is such a poorly developed and they can't do it and that no money goes there. Because then they stay where they are and they'll slowly, the forest will disappear. So we do, and the people will not benefit from development. So we do need the money there, but we need to guide that. The people who put the money there are responsible for the way it's being used and invested. So we need the banks, we need the financial institutions, we need these government organizations from the countries. And together, then that's our best bet.
Those are pressure points and important pressure points. You still need the counterpart to want to be pressured, to want to think in long term, in the long term, to think about a different kind of development, to learn from the mistakes of others. It does strike me that there's that enormous opportunity, as you described earlier.
Yeah.
This could be now, I don't want to say it's Africa's turn, but it could be the Congo Basin's turn to actually develop, as you said.
Yeah.
Certainly, we have a couple countries that aren't paragons of stability in political and economic terms, particularly political terms. Some others are more stable. A naive question. Does it make any sense to think of it as a region, or do you really have to think about Gabon's possibilities or the DRC's possibilities or Rwanda?
In the end, it will be national. And in the end, of course, countries take sovereign decisions. But if I talk about this cumulative impacts, they are transboundary. So it is
your landscape idea is transboundary.
Yeah, landscape.
That's important.
Yeah. Now, in the end, of course, the context will be national. But Congo and Cameroon, for instance, they share a province, an iron province. So several mountains in that area are just 60% iron. It's incredible. I was there. You can weld the drilling course. You can weld them 60%. So that's money. But these mountains are both sides of the border. So of course there's going to be one railroad, but is it going to go to one country or to the other?
Mm.
They need power. So they will probably dam a river to get hydropower to power the mine. That river is actually the border between the two countries. So yes, they will collaborate, and they already do. They've signed agreements that we want to do this together. That is for one mine, if you like. I would like to see that happening across the region, where there's more of a coherent approach between the countries, rather than every country its own railroad, its own port, its own everything.
Which is the history in too many other places.
Yeah, exactly.
They're national projects. We need a railroad. We need an airport. We need a port, and never mind.
The other thing that is obvious is that because there's a lot of doubt about the capacity of these governments to do it right, a lot of, if you like, credible or responsible companies very reluctant to go there, which leaves them with the cowboys. So the companies that are investing in Congo Basin are often companies who, I'm not saying all of them, but there's a lot of them who don't really care that much about environmental impacts or social impacts. And the governments are stuck with them. They would prefer to have blue chip companies, whatever you call them, the big guys, they would like that. But since they are reluctant because it's such a difficult area, these countries are stuck with B-quality companies, which is not in our interest either.
Our interest meaning the rest of the world?
Let's put the rest of the world, because the environmental cost of the wrongdoing business is onto all of us. If these forests are destroyed, we lose again one big element in climate change, the climate stabilization. We need those forests. We need the river. This week I had a lot of talk about these flying, flying rivers. So these atmospheric corridors of water. Yeah, the Congo Basin has one. And it's huge because the agriculture is north and south of the Congo Basin depends on the Congo Basin to create that water. So if we lose the Congo Basin, if we lose that forest, again, we'll have in the Sahel zone to the south of the Congo Basin, we have droughts and there's millions of people living there. So you get the same problem that you see in the Amazon with drying out of land and agriculture failures. So it is a global resource and we should feel some level of responsibility to help these governments do it right.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Our world does about as bad a job as you can do on global public goods So I must confess, I'm not hopeful that we're suddenly going to realize that we, in fact, need the flying rivers. We need all of the things we do need. And so you get back to, there's only two possibilities. One, hope that the region doesn't develop, which is obscene. Or, as you've suggested, guide it in a, learn from what others have done for better and for worse, and guide in a different direction.
Yeah.
And the question, I'm persuaded outsiders can't do that, that somehow it's got to be an indigenous, and I mean that in the broadest sense of the term, an indigenous set of decisions, that's better for us, for our people, for our growth.
So the countries have decided they want to have agro-industry and they want to have mining.
As you said.
Yeah. So if now companies that want to do it right step forward and say, okay, I would like to invest, and they bring financial institutions that come with the right type of money under the right conditions, the governments are not going to say no. If they know that they get the best quality, I mean, they don't have the money anyway. So they're reliant on other people to invest. If they get a good investment, credible investors who do the right thing, the companies will be great. It would be a couple of years ago, the Republic of Congo organized a conference in the Netherlands about agro industry because they want to attract industry to the Republic of Congo to develop palm oil and chicken farms and fisheries and everything. And it was really, and there's a World Bank who organized. It was a really good conference. The outcome, zero. Nobody wanted to invest in the Republic of Congo. And they were so frustrated because they're open for business. They got millions of hectares of land, but people just don't want to invest there because they're afraid of it. And then you only get the cowboys who say, okay, I'll help you, but under my own conditions, and they got no choice.
Years ago, I ran the country risk department of a very large international bank. And given how we made decisions about political and economic risk, we would not have been investing in the DRC today. And that, I mean, that's just a fact that there's no way that that management would have approved a large limit, which is why God invented the World Bank and the African Development Bank and the Chinese, et cetera, et cetera. And we're in the same place today. We haven't broken the back of innovative financing that isn't risk sensitive. Money's always risk sensitive.
Yeah.
Somebody's taking the risk. And how to do that differently, I truly don't know. I'm frankly not sure if it can be done differently.
Well,
with one exception. Let me now, ray of hope. For better or worse, we talked earlier about the green transition. The demand for this materials needed for that green transition is almost unlimited. The supply is quite limited, and it's particularly concentrated, as you know, in China and to an extent Russia, which means the part of the world that is now confronting China and Russia needs sources.
Yeah.
So I suspect that there's going to be a reconceptualization of risk, perhaps, or the willingness to take risk, or finding ways to offset risk, because the comparison is not, well, I could get it from X or Y because it only exists in X, or it's only politically accessible in X. So it may well be that this is part of the opportunity. If the work you've described, the landscapes you've described, if that can become mainstream, it's precisely the right moment. And it might just be that it is the right moment that you can get on this more positive path, and it won't be perfect, but it would be better than another decade of stagnation, which should not be allowed to happen, and better than destruction of the rainforest, which also should not be allowed to happen.
Yeah, the choice is there. And I realize that, of course, money looks for the way for at least a risk, at least...
path of least resistance.
There you go. The forests are getting depleted, so the value of the forest that's still standing is only going to go up. That's the way I hope to see it. So there's going to be increased value of that forest, and therefore also an increased value to protect it and not to cut it down. So I do feel that, if you want to talk about the risk for... we need the World Bank and Islamic Development Bank, African Development Bank, all those development banks. They are the ones who's going to be the trailblazers, I'm sure. It's not going to be 100% private money. But that if they step into the game and there's a solid civil society, if you like, around that, to be part of that process, to reduce risk on that money, so you have an environment that, yeah, I'm going to explain this now. It's a lot of hope in there. That's true. Plus, I think that the money will go to certain places because that's the only place where it is. Our role is to make sure that if that money flows, it's the right type of money and to prevent disaster. If it doesn't flow, that's bad for the country, but it's still good for the forest. If it does flow, our role is to make sure that it flows in the right direction.
The right kind of money. You have been deeply involved in certification. And I know that you think that that process is part of getting the right things done. It's one of those filters that raises the quality of investment, et cetera. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about that process, particularly in the forest?
So when I joined WWF, I learned about this thing called FSC, the Forest Stewardship Council, which was a tool that was established by a group of organizations, including WWF, as an answer to this irresponsible logging in the tropics. I grew up with images on TV of people chaining themselves to big trees to prevent them from being cut down. So I felt that tropical forests, you should not cut down a tree. That's the image. It's not true because we use the timber and these countries need the money. So FSC was established. It's a three-chambered system, social, environmental, and economic chambers. And together, they set up this responsibility system. And we always used to say, buy FSC because then it's okay. Then you're fine. And WF was very much one of the actors who promote that. Now, years ago, I was starting to doubt because this is what we always say, but where's the proof? Is it really better for the forest? So I worked with a group called the Center for International Forestry Research, CIFOR. And they started a study to look at social impacts. So they looked at certified companies, logging companies in the Congo Basin, and non-certified, and look at social impacts. That means the workers, and it means the communities that live around the concession. And their conclusion was remarkable progress, better, much better in the certified concessions than in the non-certified. So social, tick the box, positive. Now for ecological, complicated. So a couple of years ago, we set up a research with the Dutch University of Utrecht, and they did 4 years of research in Congo Basin, certified, non-certified loan concessions, with hundreds and hundreds of camera traps, more than 1 million pictures. And the research was published last year in the scientific paper Nature, showing big difference. Much more animals in certified concessions than in the non-certified concessions, especially the big ones like elephants, gorillas, chimps, buffalo. So the endangered species were much better off in certified forests than non-certified. So social is positive, ecological is positive. Now, what about the economy? And that's where the pain is. Because the logging companies, to be certified, they need to do all sorts of stuff and are not allowed to do other stuff, which translates into cost. Whereas the non-certified, they don't have that cost. So they need to earn that back through a premium on the timber. Now, who buys the timber? That's consumers in the West. And the consumers in the West are not willing to pay that premium. And therefore, these companies are in financial trouble. So it's a simple solution again. We need to pay our dues. If we want to save this planet, we need to pay for the cost of saving it. And with timber, it's very simple. You get good timber, good quality timber, you pay 10% more. And with that, you save the forest. Forest remains intact. Communities get a benefit. Workers have good working conditions. Elephants are roaming free. So I still feel that certification has proved this point. Same with RSPO, Roundtable Sustainable Palm Oil, has also proven to be better for the environment and for people. So certification is a good tool in the box. And I think in the tropics, that's the way forward, making sure that any development that goes to the forest respects criteria of responsibility, certification.
Let me end with a softball question, which I've seen your answer in print, so we'll see if it's the same answer. Why is the basin important to you? You spent essentially your adult life working on it, understanding it, not trying to save it. That sounds theological, but trying to make it better, trying to keep what's there. What is it that drives you to do what you do?
If you walk into a forest and it's a three-dimensional thing, the atmosphere around you, the sounds, the smells, the feeling of it, it's amazing. I get awestruck whenever I'm in the forest. I find it such an amazing and incredible place that in itself has every right to remain, and it should. And of course, the forest also has very practical reasons to remain there. Like people live over it, the 50 million people living in it. That's their livelihoods. It's the climate. It's the water. It's the rain. So there's lots of reasons. Me personally, if I close my eyes, I'm in the forest and I hear the birds and I hear the water and the raindrops falling off the leaves. And that is really my personal motivation.
I will leave it there. Thank you very much, Jaap.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.